We're at the Santa Fe Institute with Jessica Green, who is an ecologist from the University of Oregon Center for Ecology and Evolutionary Biology. You use a bunch of techniques to try and understand things that we don't see on a regular basis, which is microbial things, right?
That's right.
I think when we think about these major issues that are troubling us at the moment, the global warming stories, the mm-hmm. sustainability stories and so on, we think in terms of things that we can see. We worry about fisheries, mm-hmm. we worry about oceans and so on and so forth. Could you tell me how your area fits into the global picture?
Well, much of what we can't see is driving global biogeochemical cycles. And we know so little about how the types of microbes and their traits vary from place to place across the surface of the Earth and how that's interfacing with global change. That's one obvious reason why I'm studying what I'm studying.
So what exactly do you end up having to do? I mean, what's practically involved here? What kind of microbial matter are we talking about?
So right now I'm microbe hunting using a variety of techniques. So my own lab, we're predominantly looking at soils, or that's what we've been doing in the past, where we've been going all around the world and taking soil cores, bringing them back into the lab and looking to see what types of microbes are in the soils. But I'm also working with marine metagenomic data that has been collected by Craig Venter and his colleagues. And this is publicly available data that is covering many of the marine environments spread throughout the surface of the Earth. And I just very recently, as I was discussing with you earlier, have been studying microbes in the air, in the indoor environment. Yeah. So this is,
So, I mean, I know what Craig is doing. Obviously, he's a neighbor at UCSD and so on. We're looking here at he's finding, there's a census going on in one sense, right? There's a global census being made of life forms.
Yes.
And great novelty is being discovered all the time.
Yes.
To what end?
So to rephrase your question, I believe, are you asking why is there such a great census going on right now? Why?
Yeah.
So we've very recently discovered that most of microbial life cannot be cultured or kept in captivity in the laboratory. So when I was a master's student at UC Berkeley, that's what I was busy doing, was spreading strains of microbes on agar plates, looking to see what grew up on them, and then identifying what was there that way. And we now know that most of the tree of life is microbial, and most of it cannot be identified by using these traditional culture-based techniques. And so we're in this new revolutionary era of understanding everything about life on Earth, because we now have, by looking at genes, we now have the ability to look at and study microbes in a completely novel way in the environment that we couldn't before.
So in what sense is what you're doing, how does it interface with what Craig is doing?
Okay.
I mean, I don't want to make this sort of too trivial, but he's on this giant gene hunt in a sense.
Yeah, it was really interesting. So he was on a giant gene hunt, and it can be categorized as a global ocean survey. I know he's done many other things, but as a part of this survey, he rode his yacht around in the oceans and collected samples from off of his boat. And then they use a technique called metagenomics, where you basically take genome fragments from the ocean and chop it up into randomly sliced pieces and then sequence those. And so because this data has become publicly available, largely by an effort funded by the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation, now everybody who's interested in the world can look at this sequence data and start to make inferences about why do you have the consortium of microbes that you see from where he sampled.
Right. Is there an enormous variation in microbial life across the planet?
There is, but we're really just beginning to scratch the surface of that. So I would characterize what's been done primarily so far as like a natural history expedition where people are looking at really coarse variation from place to place. And my research, which has also been funded by the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation, is really aiming to look at exactly that. So do we see variation from the equators to the poles like we do for plants and animals? Is there a latitudinal diversity gradient? Do we see biogeographic patterns that we see for plants and animals? So I would say that we do know that there's variation, but it hasn't been very well characterized yet. So there has been some work that I've done with Jed Furman at USC, where he uses a different technique for looking at microbial diversity. And that was also with Jim Brown, who's affiliated with the Santa Fe Institute.
And writes papers with Jeffrey West on,
Yes, exactly. And Jed had data that he'd been collecting over a 15-year time period. And using that data, we were able to show that just like we see for plants and animals, as you get towards the tropics, you have a much higher diversity of marine microorganisms than you do at the poles.
All right, now, with the more visible things like corals and so on and so forth, there's evidence of insult to the planet. Does the same story emerge from looking at these microorganisms? I mean,
That's such a great question. So the American Museum of Natural History had a whole symposium dedicated to microbe conservation. I can't remember if it was last year or if it was the year before, but that was the theme of the meeting, is should we be trying to conserve microbes? And I would not say that there was a definitive conclusion from that meeting. I think people are really split on how they feel about that. So I can tell you my personal opinion. I think that because microbes harbor such a great proportion of the tree of life, that to assume that we don't need to be concerned about conservation of microbes is a really big mistake. And I think we need to be gathering more information about how microbial diversity is changing in space and time before we can make those kinds of broad sweeping statements.
Yeah, because I mean, the general perspective would be, well, you know, you go and screw up the planet, blow yourselves up, whatever, you'll be gone, but the microbes will still be there, they'll do fine.
That's one consensus, and another consensus is that they have such short generation times and that they have evolutionary processes that are much more rapid than what's going on for plants and animals, that they can readily adapt to any kind of environmental perturbation. So that there's an idea that microbes are perhaps less sensitive, that they're more resilient than plants and animals.
Do you deal also in with things at the pathogen level, infectious diseases
I
and
haven't done that yet, no. I've just been straight looking at bacteria, archaea, and looking at the community level, not looking at particular strains. But why do you see the community that you do and the variety of different species, if you're willing to talk about microbial species, but why do you see the consortia that you do?
yeah. Now, when you say archaea, I mean, you're talking about, well, perhaps you should explain.
So the tree of life, based on making gene-gene comparisons, has three domains, and one of the domains is eukarya, and there are some microorganisms in that group that we call microeukarya, and bacteria is a second domain, and archaea is a third domain.
And eukaryotes would be, how would you define a eukaryote?
A multicellular,
Multicellular organism, and
yeah.
bacteria and
Yeah.
me. Right. Now, it's not so long ago that we didn't even have that categorization, that classification. I mean, we were talking earlier with Tuck Finch,
Oh, okay.
and he mentioned that one of his mentors when he first went to Yale, I think it was Carl Woese.
Yes,
Well,
yes.
those classifications would be something that Carl was intimately involved with, right?
Exactly, and Norman Pace as
Norman
well.
Pace. And then Another biologist I think of would be Lynn Margulis.
Yeah, so it's really, there's been a complete...
But this is comparatively recent, isn't it?
It is. It's comparatively recent, and it's completely turned upside down our model of thinking about life. Yeah. From what I learned in high school biology.
Right, but I'm saying here we are in a special year. It's the bicentennial, of Darwin's mm-hmm. bicentennial. Mm-hmm. 1859 was the publication of The Origin of Species. Mm-hmm. That generation, that Victorian generation, Alfred Russel Wallace, mm-hmm. T.H. Huxley, mm-hmm. Hooker, mm-hmm. these people all went on voyages.
Yes.
Great voyages of exploration.
Yes.
Wallace sending back various kinds of species mm-hmm. and so on, some of which he lost in that mm-hmm. when the boat sank and so on. But these great voyages of exploration. And this is a new kind of voyages of exploration. I think of Craig going trawling for microbes mm-hmm. in somewhat the same sort of way. This is a new terrain that's being...
That's why it's such an exciting field to be in right now, because I continually think... we just finished reading Origin of Species in a reading club in my department. At the University of Oregon, and I continually think, how would these early explorers, including Linnaeus, who came up with Linnaean taxonomy, how would ideas about ecology and evolution be changed if these great explorers and great thinkers were able to see microbial life somehow? And I believe that they would be quite different. And this is one of the reasons that I think microbiology has the opportunity to really drive ecology and evolutionary theory over the coming decades. Mm. So it's an exciting time to be thinking about microbes.
Linnaeus's garden and Linnaeus's taxonomy, I believe, if I'm remembering this correctly, when he gets to humans, mm-hmm. all he put in there was nosce te ipsum, which means know thyself.
Oh, so, that's beautiful. I didn't know that.
Yeah. In terms of sustainability, mm-hmm. the issues that you're thinking about now, how is that going to connect?
So something that I've been interested in very recently, because I'm interested in microbial biogeography in any context, so in the human body, in soils, in marine systems, and I've very recently been thinking about microbial biogeography in the air. And so we know very, very little about microbial diversity in the outdoor environment, and we know even less about microbial diversity in the indoor environment. And so a project I very recently started is with my colleagues in the architecture department at the University of Oregon and Brendan Bohannon, who's a colleague of mine in the biology department. And we're looking at how sustainable design, architectural design, impacts life indoors. So in most, many buildings, you know, we have mechanically ventilated spaces. And 60% of all of the energy in the U.S. goes towards the energy consumed by buildings. And something like 80% of that goes towards ventilating the spaces and heating and cooling the spaces. And particularly in hospitals, I believe it's code that they have to have their windows sealed. So there's this idea that microbial life is dangerous and that it makes people ill. So hospitals and many professional environments go to great lengths to filter air and recycle it within spaces. Mm. So what we're looking at is, if you have buildings that are designed with natural ventilation, whereby you just design a space so that it's heated and cooled by air flowing through that space, versus mechanically ventilated spaces, which is the traditional way, how does that change microbial life in the indoor environment? So I think most of our ideas about how buildings are designed and the energy that's required to heat and cool them are based on qualitative ideas, but there's no quantitative information about how that's changing the air that we breathe and the biological component of that.
Yeah, I would have thought that would be very interesting because, I mean, hospital design, the iatrogenic diseases and so on, mm-hmm. I mean, it's almost, in some cases, it's well known that you can go in there and actually come away with some
exactly.
dread disease from microbes. So when you're talking about the air, external air, never mind the hospitals now, mm-hmm. are you also talking about looking at polluted air? I mean, are you talking about the kind of studies that are done by people at Scripps, for example, looking at the atmospheric constituents of the atmosphere as they drift across the planet, what's in it?
So I don't have funding to do outdoor air work yet, but what I would be interested in is what's the role of dispersal and what's the role of the environment in creating a community of microbes and how they vary from place to place. And I would treat pollution as an environmental abiotic condition that could have a great impact on microbial diversity in cities or in different geographic locations in cities. So I agree that it's very little is known about it. I mean, we know that people from the abiotic aspects of pollution can have respiratory problems and asthma, and there are many health-related aspects of that, but we know so little about how the biological components of the airborne environment interface with human health.
So when you were at Berkeley, mm-hmm. Was John Holdren there then?
No.
Okay. So how did you get into science in the first place? Was there some specific career choice? Did you have parents who were interested in this business?
I did not. I got really interested in science based on the instructors that I had in college. So there was a few seminal people that were so inspirational that they made me want to continue working in science. I think that's probably a really universal response to that kind of question, right? There might be some people that have always been driven towards science, but John Hart and Bill Kastenberg were people that really made me love science, just watching them love it.
Yeah. No, not always. Sometimes it's families. Sometimes mm-hmm. Some people, I mean, say they had terrible teachers, and mm-hmm. it was almost by default that they ended up going to science. So, you have children?
I do.
So, I mean, this is a very at home issue for you then. I mean, if you're talking about sustainability and so in yeah. very practical terms. So, where do you see this field going in the next?
Microbial yeah. biodiversity research.
Yeah. I mean, so I mean, here we now have mm-hmm. with a change of administration,
yeah.
a president who says that restore science to its rightful place, a person running NOAA, Jane Lubchenco, mm-hmm. who is deeply and intimately connected with these issues, science advisor John Holdren, who came from Berkeley, has also worked in these areas. So. Mm-hmm. This ought to be a time of great interest for these areas.
I think that everywhere you look in science right now, microbial diversity is really becoming an emerging topic everywhere. So the human microbiome research, global climate change research has an enormous amount of microbial ecologists working in this area. And what I think is the most exciting aspect of this is the interdisciplinary interface that's going to move our advanced science forward. And particularly, so what I'm particularly interested in is theory and mathematical biodiversity theory. And almost all theory in ecology and evolution has been based on the study of what we can see.
Yeah.
And I truly believe that as we learn more and more about microbial life, and as more and more scientists become engaging in thinking about microbial life, the foundations of mathematical quantitative theory that are embody these topic areas are going to be driven by microbiology. That's what I see happening in the future.
I mean, so like some of these classic equations and
yes,
back to Fisher and all that.
I really believe that, yeah. Because think about, we are all inspired by what we know, and what we know is what we see. And so when we are formulating from first principles the way the world works, it's based on what we see. But people are changing their ideas about what we know about us. So we now know that, what is it? It's something like 6,000 species of bacteria live in our stomachs. Or there's extraordinary, or I don't remember if it's your mouth or your stomach, but I mean, the more and more we learn about microbiology, we realize that it's everywhere. And so I think the general public is getting a more clear and comfortable idea about the living world that's not visible.
I often ask people, if they hadn't gone into science, what else would they have done?
Oh, okay.
What would you have done?
Oh. If I hadn't gone into science, I believe I would be an artist. But I think it's possible to do both. And so I'm working on a project with a landscape architect now on how do you depict the invisible in an architectural drawing where you're representing the flora of a region or a space in a city. So if you want to design, I mean, this links to sustainability a little bit. If you want to, and it's kind of an out there idea, but if you want to represent to the general public the living matter in a city space or in a remote space, it's very easy to do that with what you can see. But how would you represent those ideas in a visual way on paper?
The invisible?
Yes.
Sounds like a bit of a challenge.
Well, there are some. So this woman, Liska Chan, that I'm working with in landscape architect, that's her whole area of expertise. Is she does it in a societal way? So she represents attributes of cities that are not commonly represented because they have a very it's something that cities don't want to represent. But so invisible people.
We are infested.
So art. I think I would be an artist. That's the short answer to your question.
So no, but where is this? This is in Portland, in Eugene.
This is the University of Oregon in Eugene. Yeah.
And is there anything manifest? Is there anything to be seen of this invisibility?
Well, we're just starting to work on this. So we actually want to develop a new class for undergraduates that would be cross-listed between biology and landscape architecture. Teaching the landscape architects the fundamental basis of the tree of life and teaching about microbiology, and then teaching the biology students about how do you represent in non-traditional scientific ways your work. So as biologists, we learn about three-dimensional graphs with points on them, or sometimes I think the most creative scientists get are three-dimensional networks, or it's creative in some sense, but it doesn't really interface with the general public in a tractable, raw way that art can. So I think the interface between those two areas are exciting. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's come back and talk to you in a short while and see where you're going with sustainability. Thanks for talking.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay.